Breadbox Media Programming is brought to you by Jack Kane Ford. Find your next Ford Tough vehicle at caneford.com. Woodhill Community Center. Have a hand in the heart of the city. Support their mission with your donations at woodhillcommunitycenter.org. Toyota in Nicholasville Superstore. Online consultants are standing by right now to help you find your next Toyota. Visit Toyota on Nicholasville.com. Lexus of Lexington, home of the best-selling Lexus IS. Find yours today at LexusofLexington.com. Introducing the redesigned CatholicSingles.com, featuring new ways that put the spotlight on the person and their faith, not just a profile picture. For the past 20 years, faithful Catholics have used CatholicSingles.com, and the reimagined CatholicSingles.com website is ready to help single Catholics take the next step in sharing meaningful relationships with other faithful Catholics. Remember, CatholicSingles.com for faith, fellowship, and love.
Welcome to Triumphs and Tragedies. I'm Father Dwight Longenecker. This is episode 9 of a 20-part podcast series on the history of the Catholic Church. Each one of the episodes is dealing with one particular century, and the reason we're doing this history podcast is so that we can understand the triumphs and tragedies of the Church in the past, and therefore some of the challenges that we're facing today, and also some of the challenges that we will face in the future. This particular episode, episode 9, is dealing with the 8th century, from the years 700 to 800. There's an awful lot that happens in this particular century, and I would like to set the stage by backtracking a little bit and giving just a quick review of some of the other episodes that we've recorded so that you can help to see which way things are going and fit all the pieces of the picture together. And I'd like to go back really to the 5th century, the 5th century from the years 400 to 500. By this time, you remember the Catholic faith had become the religion of the Roman Empire. And as the religion of the Roman Empire, it's still dealing with some of the dogmatic and some of the doctrinal issues about who Jesus Christ really was and who his mother was and the relationship to the Church. And these things are still being resolved in this 5th century. This is the time also when the Roman Empire is beginning to disintegrate. And Pope Leo the Great is the great figure who steps up and begins to take some temporal power in the vacuum that is created by the disintegration of the Roman Empire. During this time period also, in the 400s to 500s, we see the beginning of monasticism. The monastic movement starts up as a reaction against the secular power and the secularization of the Church after it became the official religion of the Roman Empire. The figures at the beginning of monasticism, you might remember Anthony of Egypt, St. Basil in the East, St. John Cassian in France, St. Augustine of Hippo, who founds his own order, the Augustinians, and also, especially in the West, in Ireland, is St. Patrick. And the missionaries come from the West, moving east, evangelizing the northern parts of Britain, and also moving into the northern, some of the northern, northwestern parts of Europe. And so the great monastic movement begins, and the monasticism is kind of like the spiritual heart of the Church, which is moving forward all the time, while at the same time we're seeing develop now the popes as a focus of not only church power, ecclesial power, but also beginning more and more to take on some temporal power because of the vacuum that's created by the collapse of the Roman Empire. And so as they do, the Church becomes more formal with its rules and its regulations and its hierarchy and its structure. And the Pope is in charge of this administrative structure. But at the same time, God provides for the Church this spiritual movement of monasticism, which is renewing the Church at the grassroots level in a wonderful way as the monks are moving out across the territory. This takes us to the 6th century when the super important Saint Benedict is actually active and consolidates the monastic movement in his rule. And Benedict, therefore, is this powerful and influential person, which gives even more structure to the monastic movement, allowing it to be eventually a kind of administrative and an organized movement, which will move all across Europe. This takes us to the 7th century, and the 7th century from the year 600 to 700 was our last episode. By this time, the Lombards have crossed the Alps. They are a confederation of German tribes that are coming down. They're vaguely Christian, but they're coming down into the Italian peninsula and sweeping through, taking over areas that had been controlled by the Roman Empire. The eastern part of the empire had moved to Constantinople several hundred years before, and their power is also weakening. And it's during this century that they're beginning to also experience the invasions from the Muslims from the Arabian Peninsula, who are moving west and north and into northern Africa and making huge gains against what were Christian territories. And so the Eastern Byzantine Empire is based in Constantinople, and they're very involved in religion with the Patriarch of Constantinople, and the Pope in Rome is increasingly seen as a rival to the powers in Constantinople. And we're going to see in this next episode how these conflicts continued to develop and worsen in the relationship between East and West. This is also the time of the great Pope Gregory, and Pope Gregory is the one who sends Augustine of Canterbury, the Benedictine monk, to England to convert England from its eastern side. And when he comes in, of course, he meets the Celtic monks who are already there. And Roman Catholic Britain is reunited at the Synod of Whitby, where the Celtic Church submits to the Church of Rome and becomes unified together. Well, that's where we are as we come to the year 700. And by now, under Pope Gregory and his successors, the conflict with the Eastern Church continues to foment, and with the Eastern Empire continues to foment. And in fact, this particular century, there's a lot that happens, which is quite complicated. And one particular figure emerges from all of this who's very influential and who helps to draw it all together, and that is the figure of Saint Boniface. Saint Boniface was born in 675 in western England, in what is now Somerset, in the town of Crediton. And St. Boniface was trained as a Benedictine monk at the monastery in Exeter, and also at a monastery in Nursling, which is close to Southampton on the south coast of England. He was very able, very intelligent and learned. And I have a special soft spot for St. Boniface because he went to the Isle of Wight to evangelize the pagans there. And I was an Anglican vicar on the Isle of Wight for 6 or 7 years, and it's a place that's dear to my heart. And in fact, my parish, which is the parish church of Brading on the east side of the Isle of Wight, had part of its history, the legend that on the hill where my church was built is the hill where St. Boniface stood and preached to the pagans and converted the pagans of the Isle of Wight. They're not quite sure where St. Boniface left the Isle of Wight for his mission trip to Germany. They think it may have been from the port, which was actually in my parish, the port of Brading on the eastern coast of the Isle of Wight. But there's also another place further south on the coast of the Isle of Wight called Bonchurch, which is named for Boniface Church. And Boniface Church was the old church, which is there at a little haven where they also think perhaps Boniface left on his missionary journey to Germany. So Boniface is known as one of the creators of Europe. And this is why. Boniface was the one to evangelize the German tribes, but he also was very influential in trying to reform the Frankish church. The church in France had become corrupt and lazy, and Boniface comes in as a reformer, and he helps to reform the Frankish church and to renew the church there in France. And the third thing that he did, which was very important, is that he encouraged the link between the Franks and the Pope. Now, to be able to understand all of this, we need to put Boniface on one side and come back to him in just a moment. You might remember that I said that the power that was based in Constantinople was fading as the Muslims began their advance from the Arabian Peninsula. So the emperor in Constantinople of the Byzantine Empire is feeling threatened by the Muslims more and more. At the same time, there's been a clash between the emperor and the pope. And this comes up with the emperor Justinian II. Justinian II follows up with some of the conflict that had arisen before under Pope Martin. And he sends some canons, some rules and regulations to Rome, which he wants Pope Sergius to accept. And Pope Sergius basically says, mind your own business. You're the emperor. You're not the pope. You're not even the patriarch of Constantinople. It's none of your business to giving us church rules. And Sergius refuses. Now, you might remember from the last episode that the emperor had a conflict with Pope Martin. And Pope Martin was taken prisoner by the emperor, paraded through the streets of Constantinople as a heretic, and he finally died humiliated and in exile. And so the emperor, Justinian II, thinks that he's going to do the same thing with Pope Sergius. And he sends one of his advisors, Zacharias, over to Rome to arrest the pope. And to bring him back and humiliate him the way Pope Martin had been. But by this time, the mood has changed and flipped in favor of the pope. And Zacharias's troops actually mutiny against him in favor of Pope Zacharias and in favor of Pope Sergius. Zacharias, who is the representative of the emperor, Justinian, finally ends up hiding under Pope Sergius's bed, and Pope Sergius goes out triumphantly to the Roman crowds, surrounded by the emperor's soldiers who were now supporting him and declaring his dominance and his over the emperor himself. Well, you can imagine that this did not make relationships between Constantinople and Rome any better. And this situation worsens under the next emperor. Emperor Leo in 726 makes a disastrous decision. Because of the invasions of the Muslims and because of various other catastrophes and the empire collapsing, on top of all this, there was a huge volcanic explosion covering the whole place in ash, and there was disastrous deaths and all the subsequent events of a volcanic explosion. And so the emperor asks himself and the others in the east say, what are we doing wrong? You know, why is the Lord punishing us like this? And partially because of the influence of the Muslims, who are totally against any kind of imagery, which they believe any image of is an idol, and God cannot be imaged in any way. Because of that kind of influence coming in from the Muslims, the emperor Leo III in 726 actually makes a decree that all icons and all images, religious images, are to be banned, are to be burned. There's big bonfires, and they throw them all on the bonfires. And Leo tries to extend this decree into Italy through his exarch in Ravenna. He tries to extend this ban of all icons into the rest of Italy, right to the Pope. And of course, the Italians are incensed by this. And the Pope Gregory II rejects Leo's decree and says that this is, again, a layman interfering in church affairs, and he defends the use of icons and imagery in the church, and we get this clash, which is called the iconoclasm controversy, in which the Eastern Church, through Leo III, ban all images and all icons. And Pope Gregory II responds by creating even bigger icons and even bigger images and parading them through Rome and flying in the face of the emperor's decree. Well, things actually get worse. And Pope Gregory III, between 731 and 741, makes an even bolder statement against Leo and his decree against icons. Leo responds by claiming most of the lands of southern Italy, which had eventually come to be under the control of the Pope. And when you control lands in these times, of course, you're controlling the revenue flow. This is where the Pope was being able to feed the hungry in Rome, and where the Pope's wealth and power was beginning to accumulate. And the Emperor Leo marched in and took all of his land. And the Pope didn't have an army to defend himself, or at least not much of one. And furthermore, the Emperor Leo claims all of the Greek dioceses for the Eastern Church. They had been under the control of the Pope, and the Emperor comes in and says, no, these are all belonging now to the Patriarch. They're belonging to the Eastern Church, and claiming the churches and the lands and the dioceses for themselves. So the Pope, as you can see, is beginning to be marginalized more and more. He doesn't have the power of the Emperor. He doesn't have the wealth of the Emperor. Furthermore, if the Emperor isn't taking his lands to the south, the Lombards are still there and putting on more pressure in northern Italy and on Rome. And the Pope is feeling more and more beleaguered. He wants to use these lands for the good of the church, and he wants to expand the faith, but the temporal powers are pushing in on him and pushing in on the power that he has. Well, this is where Boniface comes back into the story. You remember that Boniface was active in France, reforming the French church and returning them to their original zeal in the faith. Well, Boniface makes friends with the ruling family, the family of Charles Martel, and his younger son is Pepin the Short. And in France, Boniface is encouraging the family of Charles Martel. Charles Martel is a kind of steward in the kingdom, or a mayor of the town, and not really the king. The king was a kind of puppet. And Pepin comes in and encourages Charles Martel's son, Pepin. Boniface comes in and he encourages Charles Martel's son, Pepin, to become the ruler. And so Pepin is actually crowned by Boniface as the ruler in 751, the ruler of the Franks. This begins to set up a very good relationship with the church. And 2 years later, by this time the Pope is Pope Stephen. 2 years later, Pope Stephen II sets out across the Alps to go to Paris to meet Pepin. And Pepin, who's already been crowned by Boniface, meets the Pope and gives him a grand welcome. And he actually grants to the Pope certain of the lands in Italy that the Pope wanted. And this is called the Donation of Pepin. And Pepin actually formally not only gives the land to the Pope, but promises that he will help to defend the Pope's lands from the Lombards, and also to extend those lands and to take over some of the land which had been taken by the Emperor Leo. So Pepin establishes this very strong relationship with Pope Stephen. Pope Stephen, while he's there in Paris in a great ceremony, also affirms Boniface's decision to crown Pepin, and he crowns Pepin in the Basilica of St. Denis in Paris. And he also names Pepin's sons Charles the Great, otherwise known as Charlemagne, and Carloman. And he says that they are the patrons of Rome, the protectors of Rome. And so in this conflict which has developed, Boniface, the Benedictine monk, is instrumental in forging the alliance between Pope Stephen and King Pepin. This alliance between the Frankish rulers and the popes is going to continue to strengthen during the rest of the century. This is right in the middle of the century, around 753. Stephen comes to Paris and he crowns Pepin. And this is a very important stepping stone to what is going to happen next. And it's interesting that Boniface, as a Benedictine monk, was the one who forged this alliance, because we see these two streams in the church, the Benedictine spirituality, the growth of Benedictine monasteries all across Europe, Europe. And these monasteries had become the centers of learning, the centers of culture, the centers of liturgy, the centers of faith, and the centers of civilization. And so these two factors come together, the power of the papacy, which is growing in Rome, and then the spiritual life of the monks. You might remember in the last century, Gregory the Great was actually a Benedictine monk. And Pope Gregory the Great sends Augustine to England, who's a Benedictine monk. So the Benedictine movement now is not just monks tucked away in the countryside praying and studying and working. It's also very involved in the intrigue of the church and the growth of the church and the spread of the church throughout Europe. Well, in 771, some 20 years later, Pepin's son Charlemagne actually ascends to the throne. And by this time, another pope, Pope Hadrian I, is on the throne of Rome. And if there was a good relationship between Pope Stephen and Pepin, a wonderful relationship develops between Charlemagne and Hadrian I. However, before this, when Pope Stephen made the alliance with the Franks, you can imagine that the emperor in the East was not happy about this. The emperor in the East continued to put pressure on Rome and try to assert his authority in Rome. All sorts of troubles developed in the papacy during this time. There were blindings, torture, murder, kidnapping in the papacies of Paul I in 757 to 767 and Stephen III in 768 to 772. These two papacies were troubled by dark intrigues as the Eastern powers were trying to control the papacy and the Roman authorities were fighting for supremacy. And out of all of this comes Pope Hadrian, who becomes Pope in 772. Just a year before that, Charlemagne had ascended his father's throne in as the Frankish ruler. The year after that, in 773, the Lombards assert their authority and they besiege Rome. Hadrian, calling for help, calls on Charlemagne to actually come and deliver him in from the Lombards in Rome. Charlemagne marches south and does just that. He drives the Lombards away from Rome, and he establishes Hadrian firmly as the ruler, as the Pope in Rome. Hadrian does some various other things. Hadrian is a little bit like Gregory the Great and Leo the Great, in as much as he is busy reestablishing some of the greatness of Rome as a city. He repairs some of the aqueducts. He builds up the banks on the River Tiber so it doesn't flood so much. He begins to rebuild some of the basilicas and to begin to organize Rome. And he also takes control over the lands that the papacy controlled in order to bring more food into Rome, to feed the hungry and to support the welfare system. And Hadrian's a very active and a very busy and a very dynamic pope, doing as much as he can to build up the church and also to establish the church's power, being backed up by the king Charlemagne, Charles the Great, Charlemagne. Hadrian also does something else. He goes back to the East and helps to resolve the iconoclasm controversy. You remember the controversy where the emperors had tried to ban all images. Hadrian goes back and has a council by the Empress Irene has been established to resolve this iconoclasm controversy. And Hadrian sends theological treatise to that council, kind of like the way Leo the Great had sent his Leo's Tome to help to resolve the theological controversies in his century. Hadrian sends some theological documents to the council, which had been organized by the Empress Irene, and so resolves the iconoclasm controversy. As we come right then to the end of the century, to the end of the 700s, Hadrian dies. The Pope Hadrian dies in 795, and Charlemagne feels that he's lost a great ally. In a few years later, Hadrian's successor, Leo III, is a relatively weak character. And when he was elected as the Pope, Hadrian's Roman relatives were resentful. In a procession in 799 through Rome, Hadrian's relatives attacked Pope Leo, and they tried to pull out his tongue and blind him so that he would have to be deposed. Well, Leo flees Rome and goes north to Charlemagne. And his enemies follow him there and accuse him of sexual immorality and corruption. And Charlemagne says that far be it from him to try the Lord's anointed, who is the successor of Peter. And Charlemagne goes with Leo back to Rome and establishes Leo on the throne in a similar way that he had gone to support Hadrian before. So in December 799, Charlemagne comes to Rome with Leo and declares Leo to be innocent. And on Christmas Day, the alliance is solidified even further because Pope Leo in St. Peter's Basilica crowns Charlemagne emperor of the Holy Roman Empire. And the stories that surround this particular event are very interesting because Leo seems to pop a surprise on Charlemagne by crowning him in St. Peter's as the Holy Roman Emperor. And Charlemagne said later he was surprised and inclined to turn down the honor, that he didn't really want to be in the same category as the great emperors of Rome. Of course, this sounds a little bit like a public relations exercise. And some historians think that he put that out so that the emperor over in Constantinople would not be quite so annoyed by the fact that a new emperor had been crowned in St. Peter's Basilica by the Pope. And that emperor was Charlemagne, Charles the Great Charlemagne. So there we are at the end of this particular century, which has taken us to 800 AD. And Charles the Great Charlemagne is the first of the Holy Roman Emperors. And we see this firm bond established, therefore, between the papacy and the Holy Roman Empire, which is going to take us firmly now into the rest of the Middle Ages. But while we do, before we conclude, I would just like to reflect for a few moments on what we've seen transpire in this particular century. What we see happening is the church interfacing with the secular society even more, the church interfacing with secular power, temporal power, the popes assuming lands and wealth, the popes holding hands with either the emperor or clashing with the emperor, fighting off the Lombards, making alliances with the Franks. And it's easy for us to come back and say, well, you know, that's not really what the church is about. You know, the church isn't involved with politics. The church should be like the monks, separated from the world and just leading a spiritual life. That is not actually the way God's providence works in the world. If you think about it and you read the Bible and you look back through the history, not just of the Catholic Church, but also of the Jewish faith, the way of God's work in the world has always been intertwined and interfacing with the politics and the powers of the world in whatever age they find themselves. Think back. You see Father Abraham interfacing with the Mesopotamian kings and rulers and leaving out on his pilgrimage from the corruption in Mesopotamia. Then you have the stories of Joseph going down into Egypt, and Moses clashing with the Pharaoh and leaving in the story of the Exodus. And then when they get into the Promised Land, the politics of the kings of Israel and the kings of Judea, and the clashes with the Assyrians who invade, and the clashes with the Babylonians and Nebuchadnezzar, and then the time with the Greeks and the Maccabees and the persecutions that went on. And then in the Gospels, the clash with the Roman Empire, and St. Paul and St. Peter interfacing with the Roman Empire. The Gospel, the work of God in the world, is always intertwined with the politics of power and influence that are in the world, wherever they may be. And sometimes the relationship is fairly happy, and we have a kind of Christian culture which develops. But more often, it's a clash between the secular powers and the powers of the faith and the powers of the church. And there's persecution and there's conflict. And this conflict that is there between the powers of this world and the powers of the kingdom of God is the interesting and paradoxical way that God actually works in the world. Therefore, we can't take a position which says, we need to be withdrawn and simply lead lives of prayer and spirituality and holiness. Well, yes, we need to do that, but we also need to remember that we are, as Catholics, engaged in culture. We are engaged in politics. We are engaged with the struggles between light and dark, between good and evil in the world. And it's the struggles that people like Boniface and Pope Stephen and Pope Hadrian and St. Benedict all got involved in between the struggles of this world and the next world. And that's part of the reason we're doing this history broadcast, is to say, even now, today, in the society that we live in, we have clashes with the secular powers. We have alliances with the secular powers. We work with politicians, and we work with the powers that be. We work with the cultural forces that are there in every way to promote the gospel and proclaim the gospel, but also there to challenge the secular forces where they're wrong, to challenge the cruelty and the barbarity and the greed and the lust that's in the world. Because that's what the kingdom of God does. That's what God does in the world. Through his church, we are a light, a city set on a hill, the salt of the earth. We're the ones who keep that flame alive and alight, and it's the flame of the Holy Spirit in the church, working in the church, which helps us to do that. Well, you've been listening to Triumphs and Tragedies, Episode 9. And remember, over at my blog, DwightLongenecker.com, you can stay in touch with the blog post that I will write on this particular episode. And that's in the church history section of the blog. Please come to my blog and read it every day. I'm trying to put something up every day. You can also read my archived articles, and you can be in touch by email if you have some questions. Thank you for listening.
Redbox Media Programming is brought to you by...
We want to help others, especially in places of strife, such as the Holy Land, where Christianity is dwindling by the day. But how to help? Here's an easy way. Buying products through the Holy Land gift shop. Every product you purchase at myfranciscan.org/shop helps Christians support their families and stay in the Holy Land. Olive wood, embroidery, spices, and many more authentic products from the Holy Land are available right now at myfranciscan.org/shop. The Holy Land Gift Shop, bringing the Holy Land home.
Thank you for listening to Breadbox Media. Find more about us at breadboxmedia.com.